Now, for something completely different, here is your host, Brian Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, people of all sexes, and all of you betting the high-low on the Middle East while side-eyeing the 200 vote-stealing days until November, welcome to the New News Normal episode of the Two and Only. Today's performance again features the Two and Only painfully dissonant heavy metal marching band's Calypso version of Kodachrome in honor of Jim Bovard's shutterbugging talents, with Alejandro Mayorkas and a feature role as Sergeant Schultz. Co-starring in this week's one-dimensional presentation, just back from guest rioter at the Columbia University Death to Brussels Sprouts demonstration, it's your nearly famous Brian Wilson. And just ahead of his job interview for a conservative ombudsman at the unrepentant NPR, this week's guest speaker at the 50th annual Gabby Hayes Lookalike Competition, author of both the hard and soft cover versions of the bestseller Last Rites, Death to American Liberty, and New York Post Chippendale entry for the opinion page, James Bovard. Well, Jim, good to have you aboard.
Thanks, Brian. I'm going to have to Google and see what Gabby Hayes looks like. So,
wow. Did you have a TV when you were a kid?
We were growing up on the side of a mountain that didn't get too many channels. True story.
I don't doubt that. And the signal, yeah. If you're on the wrong side of the mountain, the signal's not going to make it through to your rabbit ears.
And I did not know back then that growing up on the wrong side of the mountain would be the metaphor that described my life.
Well, you fooled them, that's for sure. Yeah, take a look at Gabby Hayes. He was had you been able to pull in that signal, you probably would have watched a little Roy Rogers. And Roy Rogers with his Jeep Nellie Bell, and I can't remember his wife's name right now, but she had a
Toots.
She had Toots, yeah, something like that. Dale Evans, I believe.
Dale Evans, that's it. Yeah, she was oh my God, she was so hot.
She was. I mean, she was mad, especially up there on Butterball, her prancing stallion.
And you see her with that rope, and she's spinning that rope and think, oh, my God.
Yep.
Trying to keep my thoughts pure.
Yes. But that's Gabby Hayes. He was replaced by somebody. I can't remember his name. Gabby, I think he even had his own show once in a while. But if you see a picture, you'll immediately catch the lookalike competition before you show up. Well, it looks like as if the mushroom cloud over NPR with the resignation of Uri Berliner has opened up a kind of a picture window on the metastasizing of passions for journalism, both at NPR and media in general. I was wondering if based on all the discussions we've had in the past couple of weeks about this whole business about journalism, I thought that Berliner's piece kind of sort of put a fine point on what should be going on at a supposedly uncommitted news organization like NPR, and what had morphed into this ultra-left news organization as far as their choice of stories and where they put the emphasis and so on. As American public, NPR is independent, beholden to no party, and without commercial interests, has a greater obligation to fairness. Greater than what? I mean, without a disclaimer, shouldn't that apply to all news publishers, broadcasters, and reporters? Is disregard for fairness?
Well, I mean, it's some fine rhetoric, and I might be uplifted if I was not jaded. I've never understood why folks expect NPR to be fair, because, you know, I've heard it off and on for decades. Some of their folks are good. I mean, I was a fan of Garrison Keillor, though not his some of his private abuses, but he was an incredibly talented comedian and storyteller at his best. But I mean, I wouldn't expect any news source to be objective. I mean, that's not the nature of people. Some people get upset because they say that my articles have got a clear perspective, and I'm saying, okay, I'm writing for editorial pages mostly, or political magazines, or websites, or places where people have where people are open about their values and their opinions. So, but the NPR thing is fascinating, because to see the see some of the videos and tweets that have been surfaced by Chris Rufo and others on the NPR president, Catherine Maher, is that how it's pronounced?
Maher. Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, she's a hoot as far as saying, well, you know, don't worry too much about truth. We'll take care of that.
And you're just thinking, all truths are equal.
Yeah. So, and it's and it's this, there's a swagger about her that reminds me of Nina Jankowicz, who was the Biden disinformation czar until
Right.
she got toppled. And I would, and if I was a betting man, I would expect NPR will have a vacancy pretty soon here.
I would think. I was rather amazed that she was as forthcoming as she was in that slant. I mean, like almost as if saying all truths are equal, that some are more equal than others.
That's a good line. Yeah,
we're more than happy with the fact that we, under the verbal disguise of we're thrilled with our people and all those buzzwords about
SOL is what it comes down to.
yeah, exactly. That's what, if they're going to start throwing letters around, how about that one? She was quoted in one article as saying, "In every American, everyone is entitled to free speech as a private citizen. What matters is NPR's work and my commitment as its CEO, public service, editorial independence, and the mission to serve all of the American public. NPR is independent and not beholden to any party." And yet Chris Rufo that you mentioned, has been pulling up a bunch of her messages that she posted on social media before she joined the network. And some of them are pretty damning if you're looking for someone that's supposed to be even-handed, calling Trump a racist. But she's okay with that. It's almost as if they're saying that because those messages were posted years ago, that they don't have that effect anymore. That it's not that big a deal. Oh, it was just 10 years ago. You know, it was just a, you know, idealistic 20-something year old.
There's a waiver of liability with the dogma. Many of the things that I've seen have been quite recent, and some of her outtakes, an interview with the Atlanta Council, I think maybe from her TED Talk as well.
Ooh, the TED Talk. Yeah, boy, that's
Yes. Yeah, there was a great New Yorker cartoon that said the hidden theme, the underlying theme of every TED Talk is that the speaker is a genius. So, and some of her comments there, she was talking about when she ran was the boss of Wikipedia, and she was distressed because the number of white people who would do Wikipedia entries or edits or stuff like that. And she was talking about the bias in favor of Western or white culture, and she said it was unfortunate that the Wikipedia had been biased in favor of written sources as opposed to oral traditions. And so I was thinking, I had some oral traditions about my youth that would make really good stories.
No doubt.
I don't think they'd do well on the Wikipedia page.
Leave for verification. They're going to want some verifications. But we need some.
Well, I think I could find one or two witnesses, but I think it'd be like Bob Woodward with his CIA witness about how the CIA chief told him all these things on his deathbed. It's a fascinating study in the arrogance of the intellectual elite at this point.
Well, that was what I thought really came out on the TED Talk. I mean, it was kind of like, it was about a 20-minute monologue extolling the virtues of everything that she knows to be absolutely correct. And when you talk about that cartoon about the underlying assumption that all people who do TED Talks are geniuses, I thought the punchline was going to be egomaniacs.
It hasn't worked for me.
Yeah, it seems to boil down to a question. Are you catering to an audience or are you pandering to an audience?
Well, yeah, that's a question. But if you see the kind of folks that buy tickets for a TED Talk, maybe they don't have tickets. I don't know. But I would be curious to see how they select the audiences, because something which I never hear in these TED Talks is hecklers. And I'm thinking like, man, if I was in that audience, I'd be making a war for some of these speakers, with all this hokum they're shoveling. But
you've probably seen more of them than I have. I'm really not a big fan of them, because there is no, it's not so much for the heckling, but there's no back and forth. There's no Q&A, at least none of the ones I've seen do. It's just a...
Hey, so look, there was not any Q&A on Mount Sinai either, was there?
Not to my knowledge.
No. So, I mean, you're having, you know, the TED Talk speakers are like Moses coming down to give you their 10 truths.
They're too busy ditching the golden calf. I think that was probably it.
That's it. Well, there are a lot of golden calves these days.
Well, at 2,400 an ounce, I'd like to find a couple. What I find fascinating about the whole study is not just NPR. NPR is kind of like they're the first one to have the curtain pulled back by Berliner's op-ed piece. Really rather astounding, too, are the reactions within the newsroom. They had their feelings hurt. They were outraged. They felt betrayed. And let's get back to the original part of the observation of Berliner, is that you've gone overboard the wrong way on story decisions, story content, story slant, story everything. Is that true or not? Because that's really what he wasn't talking about betraying anybody. He was just saying, hey, you know, take a look at this article, take a look at this result, take a look at this story selection. You know, it was all going in one particular direction, which allegedly was away from what they were back in the day. In the context of what she was saying, and in the context of what Berliner was saying in his piece, and in context with what the reaction was within the newsroom, that's what I find to be so remarkable in the reaction. It totally avoided the point that he was making and went all for their feelings and their betrayals and all that subjective business, as opposed to an examination of what did he say that was correct.
Well, and this whole myopic fixation on the feelings of the other employees at NPR. Well, you know, I'm pretty sure that NPR has more listeners than employees. Mm-hmm. And it certainly has a lot more potential listeners, but maybe he was trying to help the NPR get straightened out. I don't know. But so many of the NPR folks I've seen or dealt with over the years were just so incredibly smug. And this is going back at least to the 1990s. I don't know if there was a cure for smugness.
Well, face full of reality sometimes helps, but I don't know that there's too many things that are just too subjective about all of that. You know, the assumption of being correct on everything with no willingness to entertain a contradiction without resorting to ad hominems, that's what I find rather remarkable and pretty much across the board. I don't know if you saw that that conversation that the so-called HBO comedian
Bill Maher.
Bill Maher, right. I'm sorry. Had with Ann Kirk, where she was essentially regurgitating a lot of the old stuff that Hillary Clinton had said about the red states and the deplorables and the flyover country people are all ignorant. And because they're of their ignorance, that's why they're angry. And that's why they believe anything that Trump says. In her own arrogance, she is citing someone else's, more of a example of projection. That the things that she said were more relatable to the people that she claims are within her bubble. They're not even aware of their own condescension. That, like you said earlier, you know, the smugness probably due to the fact that they are so convinced that they're right about everything. Well, I guess you can't be smug when you know you're perfect.
Well, it's a heavy burden. I haven't tried it yet.
Not either. But maybe we ought to try that. Maybe we can get hired over there or something. I don't know. I read over the past couple of days that Biden is considering dropping charges against Julian Assange. Now, you had a chat up at jimbovard.com, and I thought you brought out a lot of great points about the treatment of Assange. Do you get the sense that that is just a whisper thing to get people excited? Is he waiting for the polling to come back? Whether the Pentagon still has gotten over its butt hurt, or you know, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. It was Matt Kibbe of Free the People, and I think there might be something to it. I don't know. I mean, you know, Biden is doing so much BS these days; it's almost impossible to keep track. And you're just kind of, he doesn't seem to know where he is. And he's actually, I was feeling really bad that I've been so critical of him because I didn't know he had an uncle that had been eaten by cannibals.
That was traumatic. Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I mean, it's like people in Scranton will believe anything.
I guess. And apparently the press corps is willing to swallow that too. Although
that's a big bone to swallow.
You know that right there. I mean,
we'll have the and then Captain James Cook was with the one. Well, anyhow, that's another story.
Yeah. Well, at least he didn't.
Nobody
make
got that joke, but what the hell?
It's all right. But I was just kind of curious whether or not that might be something. What I was looking at was a whole list of things that had he done or if he did either one or none of them, how would that impact his poll numbers? I don't think he's doing any of this business. It's all being calculated somewhere in the background by any number of people who have been pulling his strings. But that one, I think, might get him some sort of Dewey button for fairness or consideration or being in his right mind or some of those other things. So right up there was the student loan forgiveness that he's apparently willing to pull the trigger on somewhere around September or October, regardless of it being declared illegal by the Supreme Robes.
But not until after the election, the same BS he did for the midterms.
Right.
It is in late August 2022 that he announced he's got this big loan forgiveness. And then all of a sudden it's like, it was within days of the midterms that federal judges, and I think also maybe a federal appeals court, struck down his bailout handout for student loan debtors. Mm-hmm. I don't think, I mean, I certainly hope that Biden does the right thing on Assange. I mean, it's been BS. He's been locked up for 5 years. I mean, he was a hero. He deserves a Medal of Freedom. I don't know how much difference it's going to make for Biden, though, because with the way things are going, I think it was James Carville who was saying that unless the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is finished by this summer, the convention in Chicago, where the Democrats are holding their convention, is going to be an absolute disaster. You know, flashback to 1968, which you're able to vividly recall.
I can. I do remember that. Chicago, the Democratic convention in Chicago was, man, I tell you what, that was a knockdown, drag out, no pun intended, experience for any of the people who were there. There was fists were flying and people getting cracked in the head and cops were dragging people out all over the place. It was not good. And I'm just wondering with the tolerance for violence, increased violence, having grown to the extent that it is today. Ragin' Cajun was understating the analysis of what he thinks that Chicago would turn out to be. It's a lot closer to Detroit than Washington is. It'll be that whole Michigan contingent could pay a visit without too much problem.
I had not thought of that. That's a good point. No, I mean, and there's just, there's a lot of anger out there. And the, Mayor Daley, the senior, had a lot of faults, but he was also, he kind of realized, okay, well, at some point, you know, you need to avoid complete permanent chaos, whereas the current mayor in Chicago is, my memory is that his solution to all the shoplifting at grocery stores was for the city government to get in the grocery business. This is not encouraging.
It really fascinates me from a behavioral standpoint to, you know, to see people like that and these people just standing up there and saying forthrightly so much horse hockey. It's difficult to understand when they say, for example, in a couple of the swing states, the polls are almost dead even between Biden and Trump.
I mean, this is not going to be an encouraging election as far as savvy voters or honest candidates. As you said, 200 vote stealing days away from the election.
Yeah.
And that's also starting with some of the procedures that are being pushed. It's going to be a really unsavory election year.
I'm concerned. I can't put a finger on it because I'd have to be specific. But I think there's the potential, you know, for an awful lot of bad things to happen between now and then, just for that reason. That they probably know damn well that Trump would win in a landslide if there wasn't some sort of skullduggery going on behind the scenes. And their passion to maintain that death grip on power and position, that they will do damn near anything to see to it that they win or that he loses. One of the other things, just to wrap it up, that Biden is being encouraged by a lot of young people and these climate organizations on to declare a climate emergency. Now, allegedly, this is all supposed to happen to curtail oil drilling and fossil fuels, which he's already done up in Alaska. They've got a moratorium on some of that business. But by declaring a national emergency, what other people have pointed out is that whole emergency banner that he'd be operating under, he'd be able to do all sorts of things about voting and the election and mail-in voting. You can't go to the election centers. You can't go to the polls anymore. You're going to have to mail in your ballots because, you know, we have this national emergency as far as climate and so on. I can really see that happening if he pulled that off. I don't know what the reaction to that would be, considering what happened with regard to COVID, but it would be, that would be a move. Apparently, all these young people, I love that thing, young people, I don't even know if they're old enough to vote. They say the pressure is working. Biden weighs climate energy emergency declaration. This is all part of these different organizations, the Sunrise Movement. I've never even heard about that, but they're mentioned in the Bloomberg report that they're thrilled that the White House officials have renewed discussions about potentially declaring a national climate emergency.
So if Biden declares a national climate emergency and seizes extra power, seizes dictatorial powers over election procedures and compels people to vote by mail instead of in person or things like that, there would be a total collapse in credibility. And I think that the ruckus in January 2021 would be child's play compared to what happened after that. There's already so much distrust and so much, there's been a lot of bad faith across the political spectrum. You know, somebody was asked me what was the worst case scenario. And I said, well, the worst case might be if Donald Trump is jailed with all these trials and gets Jeffrey Epstein Epstein in jail. And so you have a death of a leading presidential candidate behind closed doors and nobody knows nothing. And that could play really badly.
Yeah, it's not fair that we're out of time, for example, and we've got to move along. So catch up on some of these things, you can go to jimbeauvoir.com, a copy of Last Rights, or you can pop on over to brianwilsonwrites@substack.com. But we're out of time, so we've got to roll. So for the fastidious Jim Bovard, this is the nearly famous Brian Wilson reminding you, as we see in Washington, after all is said and done, much is said and little is done.